Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Well, folks, nothing says Merry Christmas like having 5.4 million cubic yards of coal ash sludge dumped on your territory. And that's about what happened on December 22nd of last year, as you'll recall, around the town of Harriman. The TVA Kingston Fossil Plant had a breached surface impoundment, and the result was that three homes were destroyed, and nine of them were damaged. That was the immediate impact. The residual effect, of course, is the environmental impact, and that has yet to be fully assessed. But an MTSU professor and his students are going to be working on that, not only at the Kingston plant, but at other TVA plants. And Dr. Warner Cribb is a professor of geology who is going to talk with us today about that, as well as Jennifer Pickering, who is an undergraduate student who is going to be helping him with the research. Thanks for being here.
It's nice to be here.
Warner, how did MTSU come to get involved in the assessment of this environmental catastrophe?
Well, we have analytical geochemistry laboratories here, which we have been using to measure toxic metals in sediments and water, really from around the world. Jennifer, a couple of years ago, started to do this with a PhD student at Vanderbilt, and then we continued that work on sediments and water that are draining and washing from tailings piles in the Tennessee Copper Basin, where in the years of copper mining over there, the waste material was dumped into impoundments similar to those at Kingston, and through the years, the metals have washed out of the tailings piles into the streams and rivers. And so we have developed quite a bit of experience and technical expertise in terms of detecting these types of metals in water and sediment. And so when the ash flow at Kingston occurred, we decided to use our expertise to study that particular problem.
You're going to be dealing with three different tributaries, three different rivers. There's the Emory and the Clinch and the Tennessee, and of course the groundwater is a major consideration. How are you going to be able to track all of those waterways?
Well, most of our work at Kingston will focus on the Emory River and the Clinch River. And we will concentrate on the surface water and the sediments in the surface water. There has been a considerable effort by TVA, the State Department of Environmental Regulation, the US EPA, and a number of other organizations to monitor the groundwater quality in that area. We feel like that has been covered and it will be covered. We are primarily interested in the surface water quality and in the sediment quality. So we will primarily in that particular plant, we will be looking at the Emory River upstream of the plant, and we will be taking samples there as background checks to see what the concentrations of metals are in the water and in the sediment before they wash by the plant where the spill occurred. Then we'll go downstream of the plant into the Clinch River. We'll collect water and sediment samples there. We'll do the exact same type of analyses, and we will compare the results to see how much material is getting into the water and sediment from the coal ash. We're also very interested in how it is being transported downstream.
Typically, what kinds of dangerous substances are found in coal ash?
Well, coal ash is a lot of coal ash is mostly silica, and silica, if you were to drink something with silica in it or you were to eat it, it probably wouldn't harm you very much. The danger with silica is inhalation. And you don't hear much in the news about silica, but if there is silica in the ash and it's blowing through the air, that is something that people in that area should be concerned about. It's somewhat similar to silica that is produced in ash at a volcanic eruption. Once you inhale it, if you have respiratory distress to begin with, it can make that worse. The other metals that are dangerous are arsenic. You hear a lot about arsenic because it's very toxic, but also cadmium has been detected in coal ash in the past. There may be lead present. In that particular area, you have to remember that upstream of the plant is Oak Ridge. And so when we go into these areas around Kingston and we start to collect sediments, we have to be mindful that there may be, for example, radioactive elements such as thorium in the sediments that one could attribute to the power plant coal ash, but may in fact have washed down from Oak Ridge.
How would you be able to tell the difference?
You would have to take a sample of the ash itself and measure the concentrations of those elements in the ash itself. So for example, if we detected thorium, and I'm not saying that we would, but if we did detect thorium in sediments downstream of the plant, then we would want to actually go get a sample of the ash and measure it to see if there is any thorium in the ash itself. If there is not, then I think we could safely clear the ash as the source of thorium.
Jennifer, I understand that you are this project's point person on arsenic and the assessment of arsenic. What kind of methodology are you going to be using?
We use an XRF to just test for the levels of trace elements like arsenic.
And how does this work? How does this help you detect the arsenic?
It's extremely complicated. We break rocks and sediments down into a powder, press them into pellets, put them into the machine, and through some physics that I don't fully understand, mm-hmm. it gives us back a list of the concentrations, usually in parts per million, of the elements in there.
Is all of your equipment, are you going to be just taking samples and then bringing them back here, or do you have some on-site equipment?
I believe you've already collected the samples and brought them here. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have collected preliminary samples from Kingston, but yes, any samples that we do collect will be brought back here. And the X-ray fluorescence spectrometer will be used primarily to measure the sediments. And then our second analytical lab, which is an inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer, we will use to look for these metals in the water, and if they are in very, very small concentrations in the sediments, then Jennifer will be, and the other students involved, will be actually dissolving those sediments in some very aggressive acids. Mm-hmm. And then that mixture is diluted and then run through the plasma mass spectrometer to measure their concentrations at the parts per billion level. Mm-hmm. So which method we use probably really depends upon whether we're looking at sediment or water and at what concentrations we expect to find the metals.
What attracts you to a project like this, Jennifer?
Well, originally, like you said, I was kind of a lab assistant for the Vanderbilt PhD student, and the thing that attracted me to it originally was she was working on arsenic in the water in Southwest Asia, and they have a big problem over there. Lots of lives are lost. People get blackfoot disease and cancer, and arsenic in their groundwater is a really big problem there. And I was originally attracted to it because I thought I was helping people. If they located the source, maybe they could dig better wells, deeper wells, get clean water to people. And then after that, this has progressed, and now I'm using it more as a vehicle to get into a really good graduate school.
Mm-hmm. And what do you want to do? Do you want to go for a master's, PhD? Do you know yet?
Definitely a master's, possibly a PhD. I'd like to just get there and decide as it comes. I'm not entirely sure.
Okay. Do you want to stay with geology?
Definitely.
Okay. But from as far as a future career is concerned, you're still making up your mind, specifically within geology.
Yes, I'm leaning towards petroleum exploration, alternative energy, something along those lines.
Warner, there's a sort of a preliminary analysis that I have attached here, and the final paragraph says, the research results of the project will be an important contribution to studies of whether current clean coal technologies are in fact environmentally safe. We heard that expression a lot during the presidential campaign. What is clean coal technology? Is it really clean? How did it become such a buzz phrase?
Well, I'm not sure anybody really knows exactly what clean coal technology is. I think the Obama administration has made it very clear that they are not supportive of building more coal-fired power plants. Mm-hmm. Of course, the problem with that is that coal is very available in North America. It is perhaps our most abundant fossil fuel, and it's cheap. But it is dirty business pretty much all the way around, from the mining, whether you're subsurface mining or you are strip mining. If you're blasting off the tops of mountains to mine it, it's dirty business. The burning of coal has been very controversial because it produces sulfur dioxide, and this can be very, and carbon dioxide. And this can be very, very harmful to the environment in a number of different ways. How much of those pollutants, if you want to consider them pollutants, get into the atmosphere depends really upon two things. Number one, how much is in the coal to start with, and there are different grades of coal. But number two, how efficiently are you actually cleaning the emissions from those pollutants before the gases are released into the atmosphere. And I believe, in my opinion, is that in these days of environmental awareness, many people are never going to be satisfied that coal is clean, that they are always going to make the argument that no matter how much of the pollutants you take out of the effluents going into the atmosphere, you're never going to get it all out, and therefore it's never really going to be clean. But this particular disaster at Kingston, and it is a disaster for the people who live over there, it brings up an entire different dimension of burning coal, and that is the coal ash. The coal ash has not been a regulated material by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and as such, the disposal of the coal ash has only been regulated to the extent, for example, that you would regulate, say, a municipal landfill. And when you start talking about or investigating whether or not to have a substance like coal ash listed as a regulated waste, it brings up an entire volume of questions and investigations that have to be done that involve state governments and federal governments, and it's a very complex procedure.
That's very different from the way nuclear plants deal with nuclear waste, isn't it, in terms of jurisdiction, right?
Oh, absolutely. Nuclear waste is very, very carefully regulated and controlled. A lot of coal ash is sold and used to make, asphalt, for example. I believe Governor Bredesen suggested that a lot of the coal ash be used in construction materials, and perhaps that is a solution. But I believe that there's a larger problem out there, and that is that Kingston is not the only plant that stores coal ash. There are plants all over the country that do this. There are other TVA plants that do this.
And you're going to be looking at a total of 6 TVA coal-fired power plants, not just Kingston.
Right. We've received funding from the College of Basin Applied Sciences, the STEP MT program, to it's National Science Foundation money. So these funds from NSF and the College of Basin Applied Sciences will be used to fund students who will go this spring into the field. They will sample upstream and downstream sediments and water from each of these 6 plants. And they will, in numerous localities, they will bring the samples back to MTSU, analyze them for these metals, and determine, hopefully, whether or not any of the six coal ash power plants, storing power plants other than Kingston, have been releasing measurable concentrations of these metals into the environment.
Jennifer, what is the most fulfilling part of a research project to you? The field work where you actually get to get out of the classroom and see what you're dealing with, or the lab work where you reach some kind of conclusion?
I enjoy the field work a lot more, definitely. But I think in the long run, the lab work's a bit more important. So that's probably the more fulfilling one.
Mm-hmm. With something like this, how many other students are you going to be working with?
I think it's just myself and one other one.
There will be one other undergraduate working on the project, and then the NSF project, STEP-MT, allows us to select one high school student from Rutherford County, and then there will be one high school teacher who will be assisting in the project also. So in total, there will be two MTSU undergraduates, one high school student, one high school teacher.
With the other coal-fired power plants under the TVA umbrella, Allen, Gallatin, Johnsonville, Paradise, and Widows Creek, is there any record of any breach in their history that you're aware of?
There are, on occasion, minor incidents. I believe there was recently a breach at the plant in Alabama. But there's nothing of the magnitude of what happened at Kingston. Part of this is that if the coal ash is not regulated material, then the reporting of spills doesn't have to be as stringent, you know, by such stringent guidelines as if it were regulated material. So, TVA, in my opinion, is a very responsible organization. I think if there had been major problems in the past, they would have reported them to the public. My sense is that there have probably been some minor releases in the past. We primarily are interested in what is kind of getting out, what has been getting out, potentially, more or less on a daily basis. Are there any slow leaks, so to speak? Is material being blown out of the impoundments into the streams and the rivers? We're not necessarily looking for evidence of breaches of impoundments such as that which occurred in Kingston. We're more interested in just the natural transportation of coal ash out of the impoundments into the environment.
Is there anything distinctive about coal ash? I mean, if one were to look at it, would it look any different from any other kind of ash?
It's black. you know, it's fairly light. It tends to float on the water, and when it floats, it gets kind of this grayish color. It's fairly nondescript material, but it does not look like nice red Tennessee clay. So you can pick it out when you see it.
What are the people who use the Clinch River as their water supply doing, or what have they been doing since the Kingston spill? Is there any indication that citizens have been rushing out and getting bottled water? Or
well, not to my knowledge. Maybe the local stores have had a run on bottled water sales, but I understand it, TVA and the Tennessee Department of Environmental Regulation, and I'm assuming the county water board over there, have been very closely monitoring the Harriman water intake along the Clinch, and those analyses are of the water are conducted by prescribed US EPA methods and conducted by prescribed US EPA laboratories, approved laboratories. And to my knowledge, there's been no violation of any standard of drinking water quality at the intake itself.
Since this doesn't come under the jurisdiction of the EPA, that means that they could not apply for EPA Superfund money?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know. My sense is that From having been over there, we went over on the 29th of December and actually took some preliminary samples and looked at the spill. My sense is the way they are moving it around in terms of dredging it up, putting it in dump trucks and driving it down the road to wherever they're storing it, my sense is that no, it is not being treated as a Superfund site, because I think if it were, then that material would be handled in a much different way. My impression right now is that the state and TVA don't consider it to be that, you know, as hazardous as a Superfund type material.
How does one go about cleaning up a mess like this?
Well, that's a very good question. I have been in contact with a number of scientists from around the eastern part of the country who were putting together a U.S. EPA proposal, and the suggestion of the proposal is that the site actually just be left as it is.
That, like Love Canal, just let it go?
Well, you can make the argument that moving the material is going to do more damage than just leaving it where it is. And quite honestly, when I went over there on December 29th, that was one of the thoughts that I had, and I discussed that with the two people that I went over there with, was that, well, you're probably never going to be able to restore the landscape to its, you know, natural topography. The vegetation's going to be changed. There's always going to be this question of contamination. Why not just leave it where it is? If you start dredging it out of the river, you could stir it up and just make a bad situation worse. If you scoop it up and you put it in a dump truck, where are you going to take it? So there is the thought that just leaving it where it is might be the best solution. That would involve TVA purchasing the property from the landowners, and I believe that process has already actually started. And the EPA proposal that there's a professor at Wake Forest University and at Appalachian State University who are supporting this, that particular EPA proposal would turn the site into effectively a coal ash research site where people from all over the country and the world could come and they could basically conduct research on the effect of coal ash in the environment. And interestingly enough, there is a precedent for that in the state of Tennessee and in the Tennessee Copper Basin. Because the Tennessee Copper Basin, there is an area of the Copper Basin that was intentionally left untouched by the environmental regulators and the contractors who went in to revegetate the Copper Basin, because they wanted to see how nature would restore itself. And so if there is precedent for leaving at least part of it left into itself and let nature take its course.
So this land actually could become habitable again someday?
I would not necessarily say that. I would say that the idea would be basically to leave part of it as the spill left it, and to use that as a research site on how coal ash affects the environment, and also how the environment, Mother Nature, comes in and restores, in the long run, if it ever happens, that topography.
Jennifer, do you have any concerns for your own safety when you go to the site? Would there be any reason to have concern for your own safety?
I think the only reason that I would be concerned is if it had just happened and I was inhaling the ash, or if I was drinking the water right out of the ground, and I will take precautions to do neither of those.
So simply breathing the air there, it is not likely that you would be inhaling even small particles of the ash.
I think it's settled enough.
You could, but I think really our exposure would be such short term that there would not be enough danger to really to worry about. You know, people who live over there, and you know, maybe breathing in the ash all the time, that might be something they should think about.
Maybe if you're an 85-year-old woman with respiratory issues anyway, maybe you need to wear a little mask over your nose and mouth.
Possibly, but it's a potential problem. I don't think anyone has any conclusive data to say, yes, you need to wear a mask.
Why focus on arsenic in particular as opposed to any other element?
Arsenic is very hard to measure. It gets overshadowed by lead, so it's really difficult to measure in the XRF, and I think it's kind of an achievement or an accomplishment when you can do it properly, correctly.
Is it the most potentially dangerous element in the ash?
I'm not sure exactly on that, but I would say it ranks right up there with lead. The national priority list drinking limit for arsenic in water is less than 10 parts per million, or is it parts per billion? I think it's parts per million. But above that, with long-term exposure, it can cause very serious damage to a person's body, especially in older people and in younger children. I mean, in Southwest Asia, in the research I did before, there are many cases of death that is linked to arsenic in the water.
Did you not discover, Warner, on your December 29th visit already, that it is some of it has flowed, the ash has flowed from the emery into the clinch?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. There is ash that has flown in the Clinch River and has accumulated along the shoreline. Definitely.
Okay. How far downstream could it potentially get? I mean, if it gets into the Tennessee River, then how far downstream would you expect to be able to find ash?
Well, one of the things as geologists that we're interested in is how materials like ash are transported downstream. So that is one of the questions that we're going to try to answer, is how is this material transported in the stream and river systems? We're not just interested in the environmental toxicology end of this. For us, it's not just going out and taking samples and saying, okay, you know, this locality has X parts per million arsenic, this one has Y parts per million arsenic. For us, it's understanding why there is a difference.
Yeah.
Because one thing we've discovered in the Tennessee Copper Basin is that different metals will attenuate at different rates as the metals move downstream from their sources. And we're trying to understand why that is. Why would some metals continue down in higher concentrations than others? It's a geological question, and we don't know the answer yet. No one has really ever looked at the problem of how coal ash is transported in a river and stream system. And as geologists, that's really what we're interested in.
We hope to have both of you back when the final results are in. What sort of a timeline are you looking at?
These students will hopefully be in the field in May, as soon as classes are over. They will hopefully have their samples collected by the end of May or early June. They will hopefully have their analyses completed by the end of June, and we will conduct data analysis and have a final report ready by the middle of July.
Dr. Warner Cribb, Jennifer Pickering, we are out of time. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. You can check out the podcast at mtsunews.com at your leisure. And don't forget, we're also on iTunes.